You're on the air. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, who is this? What's going on?
This is Jay Nolan from Bowling Green. We're on 46th in time at Times Square across from a Mamma Mia poster, and we're about to be arrested.
Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Rita Sand.
We didn't do anything. Community lockdown. We were walking by. We wanted to see what was going on, and all of a sudden we got shut into a pen. We're being surrounded. Cops are putting up a orange sheet or something.
You're listening to a broadcast from the New York City Indy Media Center during the protests at the Republican National Convention in New York. New York City IMC took live reports from the ground round the clock throughout the protests and posted some of the audio on their site.
People are asking questions. A lot of people have MLG hats on.
So the lawyers are also getting arrested, it seems like.
Excuse me?
The lawyers are also getting arrested?
Yeah. It looks like we're all going to get arrested, and they don't look like they're going to let us out.
Today, we will speak with two Chicagoans who were arrested at that protest. We will speak with Professor Lawrence Wittner, author of an article titled The Power of Protest in the July-August Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And we will examine a recent hearing at the Institute of Medicine, where public access to vaccine data was questioned. But first, some local stories.
Affordable housing is disappearing due to development and real estate escalation, and the crunch is affecting people in cities across the country. On a sunny day in late August in Chicago, the Balanced Development Campaign rallied hundreds of protesters to march to City Hall and push for a balanced development ordinance that would lock in affordable housing. For the third year in a row, they were completely ignored. Father Michael Herman is one of the organizers.
We keep hearing that Chicago is a city that works, but there's no place for the workers to live. Who's going to do the work? So we're saying, you know, we're here today to say Mayor Daley and the city council has to pass a balanced development ordinance to assure that we continue to have affordable housing for the workers in the city.
Father Herman says the first year his group showed up to march, they were alone. This year, a diverse array of groups that cross ethnic, religious, and geographic boundaries are joining the campaign, as more and more of the working and even the middle classes are being squeezed out. As Chicago demolishes its notorious public housing projects and new developments replace once affordable rentals, the city is facing a shortage of nearly 50,000 units.
Each community is affected in a different way, so some of the north side neighborhoods are all being displaced. Other communities are being overcrowded because of the displacement in some of the north side neighborhoods. And also you'll find some people from Lakeview, from a very kind of gentrified community, kind of upwardly mobile community, also standing with us today saying that really affordable housing is an issue for all the city.
Diane Lemus from the Albany Park Neighborhood Council has also been a member of the Retail Clerks Union for over 20 years. She says the carpenters, teachers, needle trades workers, restaurant and hotel worker unions have joined because their members are being priced out of the city.
It's the members, our membership in the unions, that are suffering the most because of the lack of affordable housing. It's the janitors, it's the retail clerks, it's even the teachers, the policemen, all these people that are strong union members that are suffering because they can't find affordable housing to work, to live near where they work.
Campaign organizers hope to focus public and media attention on the problem and force Mayor Daley to approve a city ordinance that will mandate set-asides so that 15% of new development, even building rehab projects, will contain low- and middle-income units. The mayor refuses to discuss or even consider the ordinance, except to say that mandatory set-asides will kill development and hurt the people it's intended to help. Father Herman from the Balanced Development Coalition.
We have tried to communicate with Mayor Daley for some 3 years now, requesting a meeting. We have got as far as talking to members of his staff, but even bringing religious leaders downtown and union leaders, always requesting to speak with him. We have never even so much as gotten a written response from the mayor on this issue. It's an amazing issue. I've written on many other issues, and I get a letter in a couple of weeks. But on the housing issue, never have we gotten a response from the mayor to actually meet with us and to talk about how we can have some type of inclusionary zoning here in the city of Chicago.
Michael Malley, professor of urban sociology at Roosevelt University, says that Daley has indeed pursued aggressive development policies.
Once you set yourself on a track towards development, it's really hard to pull back from it and say, yeah, you're right, we're displacing people. Or the tendency is to say, we're doing this, but it's for the good of the community, and not recognizing that there are negatives for some people. Part of it's clearly a power issue about who has the largest say, ownership in a community. And this is a debate that goes on forever in communities. Are the people that are renting there, are they the community? Or are the real authentic voices of the community the people that pay taxes and own homes and frequent certain stores?
The Balanced Development Coalition is two aldermen short of passing the ordinance in the city council. However, Mayor Daley's support is crucial in a town known for aldermen who rubber stamp almost all of the mayor's policy decisions. From the trenches, I'm Lisa Smith.
Immigration built this nation was the chant in Federal Plaza on Saturday at a noon rally. Organized by the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, along with community organizations and activists representing the Filipino, Latino, Korean, Muslim, Arab, South Asian community, and the religious and labor sect. Joining the rally were marches that began in Pilsen and Humboldt Park and a dance troupe, where the crowd culminated to about 4,000 to 5,000 people. A diverse lineup of speakers raised issues that immigrant communities face. Voter registration was one of the issues, and the need for those who can vote to give a voice for those who cannot. They also spoke about the legalization for the undocumented, the separation of families due to deportation, work visas expiring, or policies such as the one affecting Carmen Estacio, a citizen and immigrant from the Philippines who petitioned for her son to enter the U.S. in 1991. Because of immigration policies, he must wait 20 years before he can come to the U.S. Natalie Hamdi told how her husband was racially profiled and detained for a crime he didn't commit. Despite that he was found innocent and also married to a U.S. citizen, he was still deported to Morocco. Deanna Mora, a student from U of I, talked about being undocumented and still able to go to school because of House Bill 60. Unfortunately, under this bill, she is not able to apply for financial aid, which is needed for most students. Despite being undocumented, she, like many others here today, has helped register immigrants to vote. Juan Salgado, president of Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, said, "Stand up, be counted, register to vote." Besides the push to vote, many people expressed participating in the rally was another way of working in solidarity and being proactive on immigrant issues. From the trenches, I'm Tina Hernandez-Lasquetti.
Former police commander John Burge was forced to answer questions this month about his involvement in police torture before he was fired from the Chicago Police Department in the early 90s. Burge reportedly took the Fifth Amendment for hours in the deposition, which is part of the lawsuit filed against the city by four men who were released from death row in 2003. Burge is accused of using beatings, suffocation, and electrical shocks to extract false confessions from the men. A 1990 report by the Office of Professional Standards, a police investigatory agency, confirmed that physical abuse in the CPD during the late 1970s and 80s was systemic. Some would say that abuse of power by police has not ended. This month, the Chicago Tribune reported that the death of May Molina Ortiz, an anti-police brutality activist, was an accident, and that a toxicology report confirms she was intoxicated with heroin at the time of her death. Molina Ortiz, who died in police custody after only 48 hours in lockup, was arrested for heroin possession, although what police said was heroin in her possession turned out to be candle-making supplies. Her son Michael, who was also arrested for drug possession at the time, was released for lack of evidence. The Ortiz family did not want to comment on the Tribune article due to the lawsuit they are mounting. However, Annabelle Perez, a friend and fellow organizer, was willing to speak out. Perez is also a member of Families for the Wrongly Convicted. She said the toxicology report is a cover-up.
I know that she was not intoxicated. I know this lady had medical problems, okay? they choose to use this as a cover-up for what they did. Whether they put drugs in her or not, we do not know. I'm not a judge, and I'm not going to judge them. But I know that May Molina had nothing, no drugs in her system. May had nothing to do with drugs. May was always protesting against the police. She was always in the spotlight. You know, if she had, if they let her die, they let her die in her cell, and they said that she had drugs, they would have seen that she was sick, regardless what. They should have seen that she was sick through the, they said they had monitors. They should have seen that she was sick, and the lady was, must have been sitting there. She was there for 2 days. She could not pick up her legs to lay down, so you know she was not laying down. So she had to be sitting down for the fact that she couldn't pick up her legs. She had to be sitting there, and what could she do? Lean her head against the bars? They had to see that, and they had to see that they needed to take her to the hospital. Well, we need to do something with this lady, because while their family came over here for the medication, the attorney recommended it, we should take her. But they didn't, and they're using that as a cop-out. They were probably just messing with her, and they didn't figure that she was that sick to die. But she died. And she died in their hands. Mm-hmm. And it was their responsibility. Any human being that goes to the police station, if you see that they're sick, yeah, that's why you are back there monitoring them, and you should be able to tell whether they're sick or not. Mm-hmm. And if somebody else is telling you they are, you shouldn't take a chance with that life.
Perez says Molina's death has chilled police brutality organizing.
It sure has. It sure has. May was the go-getter. She was the motivator. She was the one that was out there. You know, we got to do this. And it's not like that anymore. It's not that it's not like that. It's not as the way it used to be.
At the time of her death, May Molina was fighting for a new trial for her son, Salvador Ortiz, who was still in prison. Perez, who was fighting for her own son's release, says Molina Ortiz gave her strength.
She did everything with me. I mean, I did everything with her. I mean, she would wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning, Annabelle, what are you doing? This is our schedule. This is what we got to do. Are you with me? And I'm like, yeah. And I would get up and go do what I had to do, you know. And it's a big part of me that they took. And, you know, she helped me so much with my son. Now my son's got two natural lives, and I'm trying to fight for my son. And she was my moral support. She was my strength. Because it is very hard to fight for somebody when the system does not allow you, give you not even a bit of a chance to prove your innocence. They lock every door that you have, that you knock on, as to try to just try to prove. You know, they ain't going to lose nothing by you showing your case. But they don't allow you to do that. They don't give you that chance. So it's so hard. And I know May was everything to me. She helped me so much. And she's greatly missed.
From the trenches, I'm Rita Sand.